Talk World Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 40 years in the heart of downtown Chico at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 530-893-4923. All right, this is Iran Zelnick at KZFR 90.1 FM. You can also listen to us online on kzfr.org. We broadcast from Chico, California, and we service the North State. I'll be your host today for the Peace and Social Justice Show, and I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions you will hear on this show are mine and my guests alone and do not reflect the opinions of anyone else at or associated with KZFR. Let's start by crediting our underwriters. The Peace and Social Justice Show is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Love You to the Core, a Valentine's sip and shop, Sunday, February 9th at Lassen Traditional Cidery, 643 Entler Avenue, Suite 52 in Chico, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., where you can find a special gift for that special someone with live music, local artisans, food trucks, and the Butte County Mobile Library. Details at your local marketplace, chico.com. I was there the other day. Great place to visit. Highly recommended. The Peace and Social Justice Show is also brought to you by Floral Native Nursery and Restoration. A California native nursery is committed to sustainable native plants for landscaping and restoration. Floral Native Nursery and Restoration, where the wild things grow. More information about native plants and drought-tolerant landscape design is available at 14388 Meridian Road, Chico, and at floralnativenursery.com and at 530-892-2511. We're here with the Peace and Social Justice Show on KZFR 90.1 FM. I'm happy to have here a very special guest for me. Her name is Robin Marie Averbeck. She also happens to be my wife. She's an author, an activist, and a history professor at Chico State who specializes in the history of post-World War II political thought. Her book, Liberalism is Not Enough, Race and Poverty in Post-War Political Thought, came out in 2018. So it's really great to have Robin here. As I said, she's my partner. Just full disclosure, here we go. Robin's book is a hard-hitting leftist critique of post-war liberalism. It's polemical in a way that, in my opinion, we don't get enough of these days, especially from historians. And so, Robin, tell us a bit about how you came to the topic and the argument of your book.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So I first stumbled on my topic in my book when I was a graduate student at UC Davis, and I was moving away from doing early American history, which I was finding not relevant enough to my evolving political interests. So I switched to 20th century American history. And I was interested in finding points of commonality and potential collaboration between the left, which for the sake of clarity means the anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, anti-racist left, and liberalism, which can sometimes be some of those things, except for anti-capitalist. Liberalism is fundamentally wedded to capitalism. But I was wondering, what were some points of convergence or opportunities for the left to really impact American liberalism to maybe turn it into something looking much more like the mixed economies of, say, Scandinavia and other European countries? So I started looking at Lyndon Baines Johnson's Great Society, at the peak in some ways of post-war New Deal liberalism, to see what I could find there. And what I ended up finding instead was that even in the midst of the so-called Great Society, which was Lyndon Baines Johnson's legislative effort to bring a lot of the basic benefits of a welfare state to the United States. Even there, liberalism's ideology and its limitations on what it was willing to consider remained pretty hegemonic, meaning pretty much in control. There actually wasn't a lot of opportunity for more left-leaning ideas and policy to make much of a headway. So that turned into a focus, particularly on the origin story of the idea of a culture of poverty, which was the predominant ideology, I argue in my book, in Lyndon Baines Johnson's so-called War on Poverty. And so the book is, yes, political history, but it's also intellectual history, looking at how this idea of a culture of poverty originated mostly, not entirely, but mostly with liberals. There was also left and even conservative input into it. But the main thrust of the idea came from liberals in the social sciences and then worked its way into policy discussions, particularly most famously through the work of Daniel Patrick Moynihan and the so-called Moynihan Report, where he articulated his version, a kind of grab bag of different tropes from the sociological and social science literature of a culture of poverty, which then went on to be the darling of conservatives and liberals ever since, really, that keeps on getting brought up every time serious discussions, particularly of Black poverty, come up, but also more recently even white poverty, since we've also seen the growing inequality devastate rural white communities and bring the exact same so-called symptoms of the culture of poverty to white communities as well. So the culture of poverty is fundamentally a ideology or an idea that blames the victims of poverty for their own poverty. It argues that the causal line is first there's a culture of poverty and then you get the poverty, when any hard-headed analysis of the evidence makes it quite clear that it's the other way around, that all of the social symptoms that we associate with poverty, broken families, rates of crime, rates of incarceration, unemployment, drug use, alcoholism, they follow on the heels of poverty, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that one of the most important points to keep in mind is how Daniel Patrick Moynihan is still viewed today, and that your book in that regard is provocative, and that it doesn't, right, it doesn't try to sympathize with him in this way that many other people do, or try to sentimentalize post-war liberalism as this epic era of liberalism that we have gotten away from somehow, right?
That's correct. In fact, almost predictably, every 5 or 10 years, there will be a column from one New York Times columnist or another. Most recently, it's been Nicholas Kristof, who twice in the last 10 years has written some column to the extent of Moynihan was right. And ever since he was brutally attacked by leftists and civil rights activists when his report came out, we have not spoken the hard, cold truth about poverty in the inner cities. But in fact, he was right. And we need to go back to looking at the culture of poverty. Every part of this story is wrong. First off, Moynihan's ideas were never banished. They immediately became popular in the mainstream political culture with both liberals and conservatives. Yes, there was a strong left critique, the vast majority of which was not directed personally against Moynihan, but was pointing out there's some major problems here with your argument, historical, factual, otherwise. So it's actually been incredibly popular consistently from then till now. And moreover, as I mentioned before, discussing the increasing problems of poverty in rural white communities and also urban white communities, for sure, it's been shown to us that it's fundamentally wrong. That no, A culture of poverty does not feed itself, regardless of whether or not you provide people with resources and a sufficient safety net and actual opportunities out of poverty. It is quite the result of ingrained structural economic inequality. And in the case of Black communities, racism as well, of course. And we don't really need to get into a detail on how how we know that racism is well and alive and strong and still structuring our economy to this day.
Right. And really, I think personally, what I really like the most, I think, about your book is how well you figured out, fleshed out the blinders, the racial blinders of so many of these folks, including Moynihan himself, but also all the other folks in his vicinity, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing about the Moynihan Report is not only its racism as non-explicit or individualized as it is, but also it's extremely sexist. Moynihan was obsessed, not to put too fine a point on it, with the single Black mother and how he believed that this was what was reproducing poverty independent of, again, all of the economic and structural obstacles in inner cities. So much so that he was a big supporter of Project 100,000, which was a project from the federal government to get both young Black men and poor white young men into the army to, you know, go fight and die in Vietnam. And his...
And become manly men.
That's right. His argument for that was that these young Black men need discipline in a masculine world, and that's going to allow them when they come back to help their communities, because the major pathology with them is that they were all raised by single Black women. So it's really, it's bizarre, and it's amazing that people still read it today and think like, oh yeah, this sounds like a good idea.
Right, right. So let's switch gears here and ask you a little bit to comment on current things and current stuff, as you are wont to do, as somebody who hangs around you quite a bit and knows well. So how do your views of post-war liberalism inform your reading of political culture today?
In a very fundamental way. So unfortunately, I think that my book is extremely relevant still, because what Democrats fundamentally have been trying to do ever since the 1960s is they continue to try to capture the sort of mythical center, the swing voter, if you will, by moving right. And therefore, they play right into the hands of Republicans, because the Overton window of what's considered acceptable, thinkable, mainstream politics has been moving right ever since the 1960s. And there are major consequences to that, because not only do we not have a major party that is fighting for the things that could actually bring more equality and justice to this country, but meanwhile, we have Democratic administrations, Republican and Democratic administrations, enacting policies that people suffer from, that are making, you know, this growing dystopia we're living in worse and worse day by day. It's really a two-party project. And this is something I fundamentally think that people do not understand. Yes, of course, the Republicans are most responsible. Conservatives are most responsible. But they could have never done it without the complicity and the assistance of the Democratic Party, particularly ever since the 1990s, but even before.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I think especially as we've discussed several times, I was really struck by how Gabe Winant recently, a Jacobin writer, I think, or no, it was actually on a different, it was not on Jacobin, it was on Dissent, I think. In an article for Dissent, Gabe Winant talked about how the Democratic Party is, in fact, weirdly enough, more of a nostalgic party, or maybe as much of a nostalgic party as the Republican Party, and that they have this weird nostalgia for some kind of centrist bipartisan politics, where in a time when the New York Times and CBS were delivering the news, some kind of weird sense that this is what we need to get back to, which is completely first made up, right? There was no such time in which everything was right in America, and we need to go back to that time. And secondly, it's just really kind of wrong-headed and as nostalgic as the Republican Party, who, of course, are the ones who are nostalgic, especially given their motto, let's make America great again.
Right, absolutely. And what's interesting about that narrative is that, yes, there's this grain of truth in it, that in the post-war period, the mainstream Republican Party was not quite so back guano as it is today. But the people who would make the Republican Party that very much existed. And you know what they did? They dug their heels in and they said, they set goals. You know, we're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. And we might not get it today or tomorrow or even in our lifetimes. But we're going to push and push and push, and we're going to take over the party. And they had this long-term vision and they stuck to it. And not only did they eventually get what we have today, which is the MAGA Republican Party, but by the 1990s, you have the Democratic Party essentially assisting them with many of their goals. So you have Clinton in his administrations ratcheting up the war on drugs by some measures more than any other president, including Ronald Reagan. You have him signing off on NAFTA, and you have him gutting welfare, AFDC, AIDS for Families with Dependent Children, which is what it was called since 1935 when it was created during the New Deal, and turning it into TANF, Temporary Aid for Needy Families, which is a much more punitive and paltry system of welfare. It varies from state to state because states still have control. But that has devastated many families that depended on those welfare checks. And that was Clinton signing off on it. Yes, with pressure from a Republican Congress, but it was very consistent with the third way politics of the Democratic Party by the 1990s to advocate for these things and try to triangulate, right? Bill Clinton famously said, I'm going to end welfare as we know it, because he was trying to speak to that center. Now, some Democrats say yes, and he won two terms. And I say yes, and look what he did with them. He contributed to the devastation of the working class and to communities of Black and brown people across this country, and white folks as well, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, that's basically the same strategy the Democratic Party has always resigned itself to in most of their campaigns, even, of course, most recently in Harris's campaign, where she often was stumping with Liz Cheney.
Right.
Under the assumption that this is somehow the best strategy to win by catering to this mythic centrist vote.
Yes, correct. I mean, you don't need to say anything more than that. That is the quintessence of the Democratic leadership elites, Democratic elites' delusion that this is how you win and gain power. And no amount of losing is going to dissuade them from this.
Right.
By the way, I could speak to why that is, but maybe we'll get there.
Yeah. Right. And let me ask you a quick question, just given, right, our discussions of presidents and presidential campaigns. Just a quick question about Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, of course, just passed away the other day. And there are many eulogies we've heard about him. And out of them came the sense that he was a great leader of the Democratic Party, that his way was a winning way of sorts. He was a Southerner. He was a Christian evangelical. And that he should be celebrated in that regard.
So I have no idea if anybody argued it's a winning way, because Carter famously didn't win a second term. So no idea how you make that argument. He largely comes to power on the wake of Watergate, which understandably, at least back then, would make it hard for Republicans to win that particular election in the wake of Watergate. But more to the substantive point here, Jimmy Carter seems to be a very decent man, and he did a lot of good things after he was president. But his presidency actually was very part and parcel of what I'm talking about. It marked a lot of the beginning steps moving away from the working class coalition that built the New Deal and really gave the Democratic Party their governing majorities for the first few decades after World War II. And moved the government or government policy more towards the interest of finance. So I'm just going to shout out a particularly good book on this subject if people want to read more about what Carter actually did as president and how it set the stage for this continuing move away from the working class. It's called Pivotal Decade. It's by Judith Stein, and I couldn't recommend it more. It will really sort of disillusion anybody of the idea that a Carter-esque politics, at least according to how he actually governed while he was in power, was a way out for us.
All right. So that was pretty provocative, as Robin Marie Abrabic is famous for. And so let's continue and ask you just one last question about liberalism, kind of in this broad discussion of liberalism. In your opinion, is there anything worthwhile preserving in liberalism? Is there something there?
Absolutely. Of course, because much that is dear to leftists was originally articulated by liberals in that historical process, right? We're going back here to 18th, 19th century stuff. Freedom of speech, freedom of worship, limitations on centralized power, right? These are all ideas articulated either first or in concert with more unconventional thinkers, maybe like Rousseau, right? You might class him as more of a leftist thinker than a liberal one. But anyways, they came out of liberalism by and large. And they are dear to the hearts of the vast majority of leftists. However, liberalism is also deeply embedded in individualism. It is also an ideology that developed in conversation with the emergence of capitalism. And because it holds individualism so dear, it has two crucial problems. First, it has this idea that you can create community simply with the value of tolerance. That as long as we all agree that we let everyone do their thing, then we'll all get along fine. But human beings actually need a common cause, so to speak. They need values that they share to build a society around. The negative one of just you do you is not sufficient to give our lives purpose and meaning, in my opinion. But the second one, a little bit more concrete, is that this commitment to individualism means that really clear policies that work to create more equality and therefore also, the social science shows happier people, happier human beings, right? Equality is not just an abstract good. It is a lived good. We are all better off when we are more equal. Liberalism just has a really tough time with it, particularly American liberalism, I will have to say, which is what I deal with, right? Mm-hmm. It is so deeply embedded in individualism that, again, to go back, loop back to my book, even at the height of sort of 1960s, optimism and with a youth culture that was really thinking critically about a lot of these things, that deep embedded individualism and liberalism still keeps us in a cage about what we can imagine and what sort of societies we think we might want to build.
Mm-hmm. And if I recall, you had a conversation with this about this with Samuel Moyne on a podcast of yours.
Yeah, that's correct. So I don't really want to say it's my podcast because I literally record it like once every 6 months whenever there's somebody that sort of catches my eye. Also, I love to interview my friends about their political trajectories. But yeah, I do have a quote unquote podcast called On the Left. And the most recent episode is a discussion with Samuel Moyne, who is a, good Lord, I don't know if he's a law professor or what, but he's some sort of social scientist from Yale, I do believe, one of those Ivy Leagues. Anyways, he writes extensively on liberalism. He wrote a very interesting book called Liberalism Against Itself, also worth checking out if you're interested in these various types of critiques of liberalism, looking specifically at post-war liberals, but the intellectuals, people like Hannah Arendt, noting that they really sort of abandoned some of what you would think would be core liberal principles. Anyways, I have a conversation with him about how, like, maybe it's not so much liberalism against itself. Maybe it's like that liberalism is just not that great and can't get us to where we want to go. And if you're interested in hearing somebody who's kind of still holding out hope for liberalism, but is definitely sympathetic to that critique, then you might want to check out my discussion with him.
Cool. Thanks. What we'll do now is we'll take a couple minutes to thank our underwriters, and we'll be back with you shortly. This is Ron Zelnick with the Peace and Social Justice Show.
If you enjoy this program, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip this show. The Peace and Social Justice Show is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Paradise Performing Arts Center, presenting author, singer, humorist, video actor, radio personality, and national treasure, Garrison Kaler, on Friday, January 17th at 777 Nunnally Road in Paradise. Tickets and details are at paradiseperformingarts.com. Proceeds support the Paradise Performing Arts Center and by Alta Cal Bird Alliance, presenting the 2025 Snow Goose Festival, featuring wonders for birders and outdoors enthusiasts for all skills and ages, January 23 to 26. The event celebrates the journey of millions of waterfowl and raptors along the Pacific Flyway, from workshops, over 60 field trips, exhibits, and more. Details at snowgoosefestival.org and by calling 530-592-9092.
From the heart of Chico, we bring you the best in music, news, and local culture. Whether you're into jazz, rock, reggae, or talk shows, we've got something for everyone. A community radio station is nothing without its community members, people just like you. A great way to stay connected with anything KZFR is to add us on Facebook, www.facebook.com/KZFR90.1FM. Or you can add us on Instagram at KZFR90.1FM. Again, that is facebook.com/KZFR90.1FM. And Instagram, the @ KZFR90.1FM. And you can always come down to our website, kzfr.org. It's people like you that help keep community radio alive. Thank you.
Crimes have gone.
All right, we're back here at KZFR 90.1 FM from Chico, California. This is the Peace and Social Justice Show. I'm Aaron Zelnick, and my guest here today is Robin Marie Averbeck. She is an activist and an author and a history professor at Chico State. As I said previously, full disclosure, she's also my wife. And I have here to comment a little bit about contemporary politics. And really what we're getting into now is one of the most, the juiciest, perhaps, provocative conversations that were happening in the last year or so within the left or the liberal left community over the Democratic Party, over who to vote for in these elections. And Robin was quite outspoken about her position, her opposition, rather, to the Democratic Party, even as the threat of a potential Trump victory loomed. So, Robin, can you explain how you reached this provocative position?
Absolutely. Thanks for the question. So, I want to start out by saying that the fundamental dynamic here that is informing this decision on my part is that the process of the Overton window being pushed to the right cannot end unless we put our foot down. Now, I want to say that I, just like anybody else, am not psychic. I do not know how the future is going to play out. But all I can do, which is all anybody can do, is to take the knowledge from what I do know, from what has happened, and try to apply it. And I do know that we've been doing lesser evilism, vote blue no matter who, for more than half a century. And it is not working. There have been every now and then some little positive developments, but by and large, the drift of the Democratic Party has been to the right. And they refuse, most recently in their sabotaging of Bernie Sanders' primary campaigns in 2016 and 2020, to let left voices really rise in the Democratic Party. So the Democratic Party, according to my analysis and many, many others, it's definitely not unique to me, is fundamentally bought and paid for. We live in a duopoly, and they're both corporate parties. And they will not change because the Democratic Party is fundamentally committed to capitalism. Okay? It just is. That's what it is. So there's a fundamental difference between me and folks who want to reform the Democratic Party from the inside or want to try to do that, in that I simply do not believe it is possible. And I base that on things that have happened. Could other things happen in the future? Yes. But I can only base, you know, my actions on what I've seen. Now, what particularly upset people, understandably, about my position on not voting Democratic in this election, particularly at the national level, is, of course, who's the other guy? It's Trump. And I don't want to minimize too much the threat that Trump and MAGA poses, because it is very real and it is very scary, and a lot of bad things can happen in the next 4 years here. However, I can also imagine much worse than Trump, and I see certain weaknesses in the MAGA coalition and in Trump himself, particularly the MAGA coalition is weirdly dependent on Trump, that lead me to believe that if we continue the vote blue, no matter who, the lesser evilism, all we're going to accomplish in the long run, again, par the pattern that we've been seeing the last half century or so, is to push the Overton window further to the right, whether we mean to do that or not. So I do not think the Democratic Party is going to change unless we deprive them the only real leverage we have, which is our vote. To be honest, I don't know if they will change even then, because they seem more committed to capitalism, which makes some sense because it's lining their pockets, right? Even than getting in political power. But I know, but if they're going to change, they need to be deprived of votes. And if they aren't going to change, then we better get about building a third party that can one day just take over, right? So I don't know which one of those options could come to pass. A third party takeover like we saw with the Republican Party in the 1850s, right? This has happened in American history before, and a death of the Democratic Party. Or if we would see something more like you have with the Progressive Party, which was pushed push the Republicans and push the Democrats both. You know, the Progressive Party running under Teddy Roosevelt in the 19-teens is an essential part of the story of making the New Deal possible in the 1930s. So all what I do know from history is you need an oppositional push, and it can't just come from speeches or from unfulfilled threats, because that's not how politics and power works. You deny politicians power. That's what you do, whether you deny it. I'll just leave it there.
Right. And just for those who are not familiar with the term overturn window, it's the idea that certain things are possible in a certain moment, given the nature of the discussions, of the mentality, of the way people frame their ideas at the time. And that window of possibilities can change over time as part of a push by activists. So, for example, the example that many people often use with regard to the overturn window is that's what exactly the Republicans did in the 70s and 80s. They pushed the overturn window to the right, and they forced the Democratic Party to basically react to the discursive landscape, to the framing that they themselves enacted.
Right. I would push it even further. The far-right Republicans were doing that as soon as you have the New Deal, and the literature until recently painted these people, the historical literature, as kind of outcasts, the John Birchers, for example, these fanatical anti-communists. But you also have McCarthyism destroying the lives of thousands of real people, a mainstream political event that even liberals were largely complicit in, impossible, right, without the pressure from the far right. So if these dynamics work for the right wing, I've seen no reason why they're impossible for the left wing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think they were possible for the left wing. I mean, if you review the New Deal and the ways leftists injected themselves into the New Deal and framed discussions differently, I can even think of Bernie Sanders and how he helped us rethink socialism and detoxify the word socialism. So right.
Bernie Sanders, in one presidential run, accomplished what uncounted numbers of liberals would have insisted to me would be impossible, you know, years before. And he did it with one presidential run. Also, another historical note, again, you have the New Deal happening in the context of the Great Depression in the 1930s. But 20 years prior, you have Eugene Debs as head of the Socialist Party, making a real dent, right? A real impact on the political culture of the country. Not huge, right? But substantial enough to make it clear that Democrats, at least some, believe they could not afford to ignore socialist, communist, and anarchist in the United States, which were small in number, but big and loud in impact.
Mm-hmm. Right. And which election was it? The
1912
election, he won what, 12% or 8%, something of the vote?
I can't recall, so I don't want to guess. But something much larger than we would ever expect from a third party today.
Right, as the leader of the Socialist Party.
Correct.
Right. All right. Let me ask you this, though. Has anything changed over the last few months? Have you rethought your position?
Not really. we're seeing chaos in the early stages of the Trump administration, for example, the nomination and then unnomination of Matt Gaetz, which suggests that, to me at least, that he hasn't, quote unquote, learned his lesson in the way that many liberals were worried that he has, meaning that he doesn't appear to have come in super ready to govern. 2016, I didn't know what I was doing, but now I know exactly what I'm doing, and I have the Heritage Foundation behind me with Project 2025, and we're going to roll. Now, even as I say that, I somewhat regret my sarcastic tone, because it could happen, right? And it's really frightening. But at this point, it doesn't seem to me like Trump has turned into a master political navigator when he's actually in power yet. But I do want to emphasize that I don't know what will happen, and nobody does. And therefore, all we can do is try to push for the things we believe in. But I don't feel like you can do that and support the Democratic Party, because I think the Democratic Party is fundamentally opposed to everything that the left believes in.
So the counter to your position presumably would be that there's ways to reform the Democratic Party from within, right? That, you know, in the past, these kind of things happen. Workers from within, it happened from within the Republican Party, say with Trump. So one could presumably try to change the Democratic Party from within, for example, through the primary process. Is that something that you're supportive of? How do you, what's your answer to people who are more reformists than, say, outright leftists?
Sure. So first, I would like to say that I do immensely respect anybody who's pouring their time and energy into pursuing that path, particularly at the local and state level, right? I'm not going to say that that's a waste of your time, because it very well might not be. Even if you don't, you know, change the world or change your state, you could make some positive changes on the local level. I mean, even looking here at Chico, it was really encouraging seeing this last city council election, right? And this attempt to work outside the bounds of the usual. However, there's two problems with the whole let's just primary centrist Dems out, right? And replace them with progressives. First, the infrastructure for the level of participation, vote participation we would need is not there. Very few Americans vote in primaries. Understandably, I mean, only like half the country votes in national elections, for goodness sake, because we don't have holidays for voting. Voting's not required like it is in some countries, Australia, for example. I think that's for national voting, but maybe elsewhere too, or other levels. People don't have days off work. They don't have the time, the energy to educate themselves about all of these.
They don't need to be registered to vote, which is a weird thing.
You have to register, which is bonkers, right? That should not be a thing. Sorry, this is another thing that we're totally shunting aside any mainstream notions about, well, you have to have some registration. No, you don't. Okay. So to say like, well, we should all vote in the primaries, I'm like, well, that's just not a realistic understanding of the fact that most Americans are out of touch with the political system because it doesn't serve them in any way. And they're too busy trying to survive to vote in primaries, right? It's many, even in national elections, let alone primaries. The second point to that is if we should somehow overcome all those obstacles, and by the way, really quick, if anybody is working on, right, reforming the electoral system, yes, awesome, go for it, right? Ranked choice voting, no registration, all that stuff, that's a worthy effort. But anyways, even if we're able to overcome all those obstacles or get them replaced with better electoral policies, I personally feel that the Democratic Party will do everything they can to block the major success of progressive rise within their own ranks. That is informed by what they did to Bernie in two presidential campaigns, and many others besides AOC, right, was not able to get on the top of this committee leadership recently. This is par the course with the Democrats. They will stab their own progressives in the back if they really start to pose a threat. And that makes perfect sense because they are a party of capital.
Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, the case of Adam Schiff here in California is also pretty notorious, how he really manipulated voting in this pretty nefarious ways in order to get elected as a senator here. And anyway, let's ask you this one last current events question. What kind of scenarios worry you the most in the next few years?
Well, first, there's of course the worst case scenario, which is some sort of authoritarian takeover via Trump and MAGA. And I think sometimes when I talk to people about my position of abandoning the Democratic Party and trying to build some sort of third party alternative, that they don't think I appreciate how scary this is. But I have been awake at night on the verge of tears asking you, do we need to make a game plan for when we leave, right? What are the signs? We don't want to be the people that leave too late, right? Or join the resistance too late, like an actual resistance, like not hashtag resistance. So that's terrifying. And it is possible. Again, I don't know what's going to happen. But fear is it's wise to listen to the instincts of fear. Fear is there to, you know, help you survive up to a point. I don't want my political actions and my energy to be poured into something driven by fear. I want to fight for things I believe in. I want to fight for things that could make things better, not just accept this lesser of two evils. And my bigger fear, not in terms of it being worse, but in terms of me thinking it's more probably what will happen, what will more likely happen, is that the next 4 years and 8 years and 20 years and 30 years will just be like the last half century, where we're always so afraid of what the Republicans or the conservatives or now MAGA will do, that we always vote blue no matter who, that we always accept the lesser evil, that we throw other people under the bus endlessly. Right now, it would be Palestinians, of course, who are suffering a genocide, who so many people said, yeah, that's horrible. But if I don't vote for the people doing that to you, then other people that will do that to me will get in power. I mean, that is fundamentally, right, the compromise, or the what's the expression, the Faustian bargain that we're making, that things will just continue to get worse. The Democratic Party will continue to either stay where it is or drift even further rightward. Inequality get worse. Homelessness will get worse. Addiction will get worse. Fewer people will have, you know, a roof over their heads they can afford. And that will just keep straggling along like this until I don't know at what point we reach official dystopia. But that, to me, that is the more realistic scenario that makes me feel a more palpable in sense of, like, on my doorstep sense of despair.
Right. And I think that, you know, there's a pretty compelling rationale there, just kind of if you think a bit about it rationally. I mean, you think about George W. Bush, how everybody was saying that we can't vote for Nader because we have to make sure that George W. Bush, which at the time seemed like the worst thing possible, will not be able to take office. And then lo and behold, some years later, we have Trump. And so that strategy has not worked out, this strategy of a short-term game plan, of us prioritizing the short term, ensuring that, you know, this particular person won't get elected, but ultimately not doing anything about the long term. And so I think ultimately what's going on here is a balancing of kind of some long-term analysis versus short-term analysis. And ultimately, you know, I think it's a compelling point whether or not you have, how you evaluate those short-term and long-term analyses is a question, is an open question. But I think it's quite as compelling to suggest that the long-term should be prioritized once in a while ahead of the short-term. So that's just how I viewed things and how I think that, I'm not as committed as you to that position, I can see that it is rational and compelling. All right, let's move on to talk a little bit about what you're working on now. What's your current book project right now?
So I'm currently working on a book that will be a collection of essays that continue with this theme of critiquing liberalism from a left position, but is much more contemporary commentary and is also a little bit more casual in the sense that it's very personality forward. If you read my book, Liberalism is Not Enough, I think I have one joke in there. Whereas if you read one of these essays, it's sort of dripping with, I guess, what I'll call my shtick. But there's so much fun to write. And more importantly, I just have to get some things out of my system and put pen to paper about how liberalism really fundamentally shapes our political imagination. And it has certain, I guess I'll say, tropes or assumptions that are so embedded that we don't think critically about them. And I think they're really detrimental to building a political culture that will be able to get us out of this mess called capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, all of them are associated with liberalism, with the Democratic Party, with these kind of hallowed liberal ideas. So, for example, I know that one of your essays you're preparing for the book is on this guy called William F. Buckley. You might have heard of him. So can you tell us a bit about this essay and about that that guy?
Absolutely. So first I'll just explain who William F. Buckley, Aron has, is grinning at me. Because he knows what a lovely ball he just tossed me. William F. Buckley was a political journalist and activist, conservative, further right than the vast majority of his Republican colleagues when he started. He founded the National Review, and he had a television show called Firing Line for years and years, where he brought on a lot of liberals and also leftists. And he was very good at performing intelligence, and he had this sort of witty banter in a mid-Atlantic accent. And a lot of liberals foolishly are sentimental about, wow, back when conservatives could at least have an intellectual conversation. And some of them also knew him personally and apparently thought we needed to know what a good guy he was in person and that he was a nice friend, even if you disagreed with him. And the essay is not so much about Buckley. It's about the liberal infatuation with William F. Buckley, both how they misunderstand his actual impact, and also how when we make political statements about people who have a political impact, which means they impact people's lives, right? We need to speak from a position of solidarity. So if you personally, say, had a nice friendship with William F. Buckley, that's fine, but you don't talk about him as though he was a great guy or a decent person in public once he died, as many, many liberals did, because he contributed to policies that killed people. I mean that quite literally in some cases, right? And made people's lives worse. And his life's work was awful. So we need to make this distinction, actually, between, you know, our personal interactions with people and what our responsibility is to the victims of political policies. But so much of liberalism is this just wanting to have a nice chat with people we disagree with, as though that is what's going to make this world more just. Right. And I can tell you as a historian that, you know, it can't hurt, but it's never played the primary role ever in making this world a better place.
Right. And that's kind of part of that nostalgia that we described before.
Correct.
That the Democratic Party and the liberal tradition in general is weirdly nostalgic for some kind of era that never really existed in which everything was kind of civil in America.
Well, I mean, I don't know that it's so much that it never existed. It's that the consequences didn't fall on them. Right? So William F. Buckley is great because he can string a sentence together. Trump is beyond the pale, though, because he's a rambling clown. I certainly don't dispute that he's a rambling clown, but William F. Buckley promoted horrible, horrible things for his entire life. Why do we want a resurgence of the articulate evil dude, mm-hmm. right? Why be nostalgic for that? And I think the reason is because liberals just want to, you know, have a nice conversation and feel like they're doing politics in some sort of West Wing fantasy, i.e. the TV show The West Wing, rather than keep their eye on the ball of the working class and the ostracized and discriminated against populations in the country and how these policies, whether they're articulately argued for or not, are being passed.
Right. And just to kind of give us a sense of what type of policies he supported. Do you have any examples?
He was a huge cold warrior, so he was gung-ho about Vietnam. He was homophobic, and most notoriously, he was a supporter of letting white people have political control in the Jim Crow South all the way up until I think the early 2000s. He admitted that maybe more federal intervention was necessary there. But he famously had this debate with James Baldwin, which you can easily look up on YouTube, which makes it pretty clear. Also in a National Review article he wrote, column he wrote, where he said, like, yeah, you know, for the time being, the white race is the more, I'm paraphrasing, but only barely because I've read this quote so many times, the white race is the more advanced race because of education and blah, 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 and culture, again, that culture idea popping up. So he wasn't an advocate of biological racism, but he certainly made common cause with biological racists, and he was one of the, you know, first promoters of this cultural version of racism where it's like, no, of course, I don't think Black people are naturally or biologically speaking inferior, but, you know, they have a culture problem. And so he quite explicitly said white folks should have political control in the South until that's no longer the case. Although, of course, he didn't have any suggestions for how to make that no longer the case.
Right. And, you know, we've kind of come full circle because Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
They were buddies.
Right. Was friendly with this guy and helped provide him with the talking points that he needed.
That's right.
In order to push his conservative ideas.
Buckley was a huge fan of the Moynihan Report, which is almost all you need to know about it.
Right.
Conservatives to this day on Fox News still bring it up. And Nicholas Kristof, who fancies himself, you know, this progressive Democrat, also brings it up all the time.
Right, right. And so I guess since we've come full circle, this is an apt moment to end the interview. But before that, maybe tell us, Robin, where those who are eager to follow your polemical insights can look at, look you up.
So I have a website called Dogs, Revolution, and Whiskey. Maybe not in that order. I'm not sure. Anyways, you can type my name, Robin Marie Averbeck, into Google. It will be one of the first hits. You can also follow me on Twitter at Robin Marie 1789.
Which is, of course, a reference to the French Revolution. All right. This was Eran Zelnick. I had here Robin Marie Averbeck with me. This is the Peace and Social Justice Show. This is KZFR 90.1 from downtown Chico, California. I'll be here again next month. Peace.
In every American community, you have varying shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. An outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally. So here then is a lesson in safe logic. I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it? I go to civil rights rallies, and I put down the old D.A.R. D.A.R., that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen. My faith in the system restored. And I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
Oh, I wouldn't have faded that song out. If I knew it was going to fade out, I would have faded it out right at 1 o'clock to start Playing Dead. So anyway, stay tuned for Playing Dead right here on KZFR Chico.
This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with your host,